This is Audible.
HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Things That Make White People Uncomfortable by Michael Bennett and Dave Zirin. Foreword by Martellus Bennett. Read by J.D. Jackson. This book is dedicated to my parents, who sacrificed for me year after year, who taught me what it means to be a leader and a man, as I watched them work and give. To my ancestors who didn't have a voice but who survived, I'm grateful to stand on their shoulders and never let their spirit die. To my brothers and sisters, whom I love and for whom I am so thankful. To my brother Martellus, who has been a guiding star in my life and always believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. Our success has been tied together, and we have a relationship that can't be broken. To the love of my life, Pele, my biggest blessing, who taught me how to love and how to be vulnerable. I'm thankful for you. This book was powered through your love. To my daughters Peyton, Blake, and Ollie, I can't say enough for what you guys have done for me. I love you guys. Thanks for making me become selfless. Everything I do is for you. Last, to people who don't believe in themselves and are scared to be vulnerable, I hope this book encourages you to stand up for yourselves and your communities. We have got to make the white population uncomfortable, because that is the only way to get their attention. Bill Russell. I'm not concerned with your liking or disliking me. All I ask is that you respect me as a human being. Jackie Robinson. Forward. Growing up, we didn't have any superheroes dressed in capes, wearing spandex and a pair of freshly skidmark-free underwear who looked like us. The caped heroes weren't saving brown people in their movies, comics, or cartoons. Superman came all the way from planet Krypton to save white folks. Spider-Man has never swung through the hood, hanging from his web to scoop a family in the projects from a burning building just before it collapsed. Batman has never rolled through Section 8 in his Batmobile to save anyone. There's a ton of little black girls who could have used Wonder Woman and that lasso of hers. Unfortunately, they're still waiting. Shit, you would have thought that Aquaman had gotten the memo that black people can't swim and came to the hood in the summer to hang out by the pool and save lives. He probably would be more popular these days. But he didn't, and people drowned. Superheroes don't come to underserved communities. Superheroes aren't on Earth to save minorities. Superheroes are here to save white America. Knowing this as kids, the superstar athletes became our superheroes. They didn't leap over tall buildings, they leaped from the free throw line. They ran faster than speeding bullets through the finish lines, breaking records. They didn't have superhuman strength to break through walls, but they did break down barriers. They didn't come through the hood in the Batmobile, but they did come through in Bentleys. They came to our communities, unlike the spandex-wearing heroes on our televisions. They brought hope, change, turkeys, educational programs, toys, and wisdom with them. Rather than hearing stories through scripts, we heard stories from our heroes' lips in person. Stories that we could connect to, told by heroes who looked like us. Superheroes we felt we could be. We bought jerseys instead of capes, gym shoes instead of the required superhero boots, headbands instead of masks. These were our truths. The guys flying across the screen weren't going to save us. It was up to athletes soaring through the sky and slam dunking. Athletes became our superheroes, and it was up to them to save us, protect us, give us a voice. Muhammad Ali, John Carlos, Colin Kaepernick, Tommy Smith, and Jim Brown, to name a few. So when an athlete protests the state of the world, he's seen by many as an ungrateful dumb jock, lucky to be a millionaire for playing a stupid sport. But when we look at an athlete protesting, what we see is our superhero attempting to save us again. My brother Michael is continuing the battle of the supers before him. Wow! My brother is a superhero! That's some pretty cool shit to say out loud. I am proud to know that my brother is one of the supers that the minority youth and communities can trust to fight their fights, give them voices, and do his best to protect them. I always knew Mike would be a superhero because, for as long as I can remember, he's been my personal hero, saving me so many times over the 30 years we have spent together. I'm old enough to fight my own battles now, and I've discovered my own superpowers thanks to him, so I don't mind sharing him with the world now. I mean, who couldn't use their personal superhero? A couple things you should know about this superhero if you dare choose him to be yours, as I did for most of my life. He can't fly or hold his breath for extremely long periods of time, although he can swim. He doesn't drive an invisible plane or have X-ray vision. He can't disappear, turn big and green, or shoot spider webs from his wrist. Shit, I am starting to rethink this whole thing. I mean, what can he do? He's more of a blank man than Batman. To be honest, Mike had no choice but to be a superhero because our dad was the original Mr. Incredible, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So what is Mike's superpower? It's his unfiltered voice and ability to make people uncomfortable. If you ever sat at a table with Mike, you'd begin to feel uncomfortable before the waiter could deliver the appetizers. I mean, the guy wastes no time. He's the dude you have to warn your guests about before coming over, like, hey, my bro Mike is a great guy, but there's no telling what the fuck he is going to say. But if you listen, he has a lot of great thought-provoking things to say in between the jokes about your hair, shoes, or teeth. So guess what? This is your warning. Ain't no telling what the fuck he's about to say. Enjoy being uncomfortable, waiter. Martellus Bennett, January 2018. Preface. The Sit-Down. On Fear. I couldn't see another hashtag Sandra Bland, hashtag Tamir Rice, hashtag Walter Scott, hashtag Eric Garner. The list goes on and on and on. At what point do we do something about it? Colin Kaepernick. It was our first preseason game in 2017. I couldn't even tell you who we were playing because the thoughts in my mind were like cars smashing into each other with screeching tires, broken glass, and blood on the streets. I was thinking about American Nazis marching in Charlottesville and the young woman who was killed. I was also thinking about Charlena Lyles, mother of four, pregnant, who called Seattle police for help, and they shot her to death with seven bullets, four in her back. I was thinking about my friend Colin Kaepernick, denied a job in the National Football League because of his protests against racism and police violence that he staged during the national anthem, the stand he took for equality and justice. I was thinking about my mom, a teacher for over 20 years who taught me to question everything. I was thinking about the gap between what we are taught the flag represents and the lived experience of too many people. I was thinking about all of this, and as the anthem started to play, I sat down. There was no way I could stand for the national anthem, and there was no way I would until I saw this country take steps toward common decency. By not standing, I wanted to honor the founding principles of this country. The freedom of self-expression, liberty, and the equal opportunity to pursue happiness, and challenge us to try to reach those goals. I wanted to use my platform to inspire young people to see us not just as athletes or pitchmen for products, but as change makers. It was something I had to do. Charlottesville brought back memories of growing up in Texas and being afraid, sometimes even to breathe. It brought tears to my eyes to see people armed to attack somebody because of the color of their skin or their religion. I couldn't believe it took Trump 48 hours to respond. And then I couldn't believe when he said, "Very fine people were marching in an army of hate and violence." At this point, I think if you're being silent, you're making a choice and taking a side. As NFL players, we cannot be silent anymore just because we have the ability to hide beneath our helmets. I can't hide behind the shield. I can't hide behind the glamour and glitz of football and fame. The reality is that I'm a black man in America, and I'm going to be a black man in America long after I'm out of this league. There is too much in this country dragging down the poor women and kids, and we can't be hiding behind gated communities pretending these things are happening somewhere else. So I sat during the anthem, and the hate came in as sure as night follows day. I'll leave out the worst, but I will say that the fact it made people angry, uncomfortable, and even hateful was proof that I was right to make a stand and take a seat. If I'd protested for the right of men to grow beautiful beards like my own, no one would have cared. And if no one cared, then I would have been wasting everyone's time. Of all the responses, what bothered me most was when people said I was dishonoring the military. It got under my skin because I also heard from a ton of veterans who said, we wore the uniform precisely so people would have the freedom to protest. It bothered me because my father was in the military. I love my father, but I don't love the hatred I see growing in this country. I love the soldier who, after I started my protest, sent me an American flag from Afghanistan, shaded by dust and dirt from thousands of miles away, and said he stood with me. I want to use this platform to reach people, to encourage us, to see how unselfish we can be. Just because people don't eat what you eat, just because they're not from where you're from, just because they don't pray to the same God you pray to, just because they don't love who you love doesn't mean they should be treated like they are less than human. I want us to aspire to love one another, in all our difference. To me, sitting during the anthem is not being divisive. The way those Nazis and Fox News are using the flag is divisive. My hope is to bring people together. It's so much easier to put up walls. I also took a stand for Colin Kaepernick. Colin is one of the best fighters for justice and equality in sports history. I think people assumed the anthem actions would go away because he was out of the NFL, but there's still a fight going on. Racism and social inequality haven't gone away. Just because Colin Kaepernick is not playing doesn't mean the fight is over. Like Fred Hampton said, you can jail the revolutionary, but you can't jail the revolution. They can lock Kaepernick out of the league, but more and more players are taking up the cause. If the franchise owners thought that keeping Colin out would silence us, that just insults us as men. Guess what? Considering the ego and drive it takes to be a pro athlete, being told to shut up and play, shut up and dance, shut up and take the warning, compels us to push right back. It makes some people so angry to see us taking a stand or taking a knee. I get that they watch football to escape, and they view us as entertainers, here to give them a break from the so-called real world. But we aren't machines. We are human beings, and we aren't paid to stand for an anthem. We are paid to play football. This is our real world. Maybe some people figure that being a professional athlete somehow graduates us from racism. They think we're not that black. We're in another category. But if I'm someplace where people don't know me as Michael Bennett, I am a black man judged by the color of my skin. I lived through this last August in Las Vegas, where I was put on the ground, a weapon placed against the back of my head, and a police officer said he was going to blow my fucking head off. I'll be talking more about that night later because in this case, what happened in Vegas isn't staying in Vegas. We have the right to protest, and we, like anyone else, can try to be heard. They also tell us to stick to sports when we speak out on issues, but they don't seem to have a problem when we're making commercials, selling their kids sneakers they can't afford or fast food that will give them colon cancer. I don't see how that is sticking to sports, but somehow that is considered okay. A cartoon by my brother Martellus nails it. The reaction to all of this went off the charts when Donald Trump gave a speech at a rally in Alabama that attacked us for protesting and went after the NFL for not firing us. He also described any player who took a knee as a son of a bitch. Well, all right then. No confusing how he feels. He took the flame that Colin had lit and poured gasoline all over it. But Donald Trump never played football and does not understand our brotherhood. I'll go into that later, what the NFL brotherhood is and what it means. But I knew that our brotherhood would come into play. That's why as soon as I heard what he said, and my phone started blowing up and the fury of my friends was making my ears bleed, I felt really calm, almost like a big bearded Buddha. Even though he singled out those of us who protested, I felt like he was taking on the whole NFL, so I never really felt alone. Instead, and I know this might sound twisted, I felt an incredible sense of positivity. I just thought, hey, he's entitled to his opinion. I'm not about to go back and forth with him because that's not what this is about. I don't know who that helps. A lot of players were tweeting and talking volumes of anger. NBA players Chris Paul even dared Trump to say it to our faces. He hasn't. My only public response was that he shouldn't be saying, son of a bitch, no matter what he thinks about us, because, president or not, you don't talk about people's mothers. In a tweet I wrote, my mom is a beautiful lady, and she has never been a bitch. But I was also proud. Wow, we got under the skin of the President of the United States. I was grateful. Even though he disagreed with us, he turned it into a worldwide conversation. Maybe he wasn't willing to have a discussion with us about what we were protesting and why it mattered. No beer summit for us. But his comments did allow for us to go global with the problems of racial inequality in this country. He also brought the NFL family together, activating the brotherhood as if his comments were some kind of NFL bat signal. His mistake was taking on the whole NFL. Owners don't like it when you tell them who to hire and fire, and you don't talk about people's moms. He also crossed a line. He is a habitual line stepper. When he said that the game has become too soft. Everyone in the NFL, from owners to players, knows the toll this game takes on our bodies, and nobody who sees us after games or in the training room would dare say such a thing. In that moment, I saw the part of the man that makes me feel pity. He has no ability to walk in other people's shoes, to see the world from another perspective, from Puerto Rico to the NFL. He doesn't care about Dave Duerson, Junior Seau, Kenny Stabler, or anyone who passed away before his time. He doesn't know what it's like to wrench your neck because someone faster and stronger than anyone who played even 20 years ago hits you like a truck. Yes, the rules have changed, but that's because players are so big and fast now. There wouldn't be any of us left if the headhunting days were still in effect. I heard that part of his speech and just said, he don't really know, you know? Then on Sunday, September 24th, history. It was the first time the national media had covered the anthem actions, and the protests hit every single team. You even had Trump supporters on the pregame shows, like former coach Rex Ryan, who had introduced him at campaign rallies, taking the president to the woodshed. The previous Sunday, 9 of us players had protested during the anthem. Now we were talking 180 to 200 people, players, coaches, even owners. It was a league standing together to say that we were not going to be treated like this. More than any issue for which we had knelt before, now the protests were also about self-respect. Josh Norman, the cornerback for Washington, put it the right way afterward. It's not about the flag, man. Nobody is spitting on the flag or disrespecting it. We know you gave your life for it. We know that. And our gratitude to your services is deeply endeared. Understand that. But if somebody comes on your front porch and takes a piss as a man, what are you going to do? Sit there and just watch him pee? Or are you going to step outside and be like, hey, what are you doing, sir? You're on private property. You've got to get off, or we'll make you get off. What a day that was. Some raised a fist, some knelt, some linked arms, and some stayed in the locker room while the anthem played, our absence being the strongest possible statement. That's what the Seahawks did, and the team we were playing, the Tennessee Titans, did the same thing. Meanwhile, the woman singing the anthem, a country performer, took a knee. That made two anthem singers that Sunday who took a knee on the last note. A black man in Detroit and a white woman in Nashville. In a divided country, we were forging unity, the unity of people who think we can do better. What was so cool about the Titans also staying in the locker room was that it didn't come out of a long conversation with the players on that team. We were all just on the same wavelength and did what we believed in. In that moment, we shared a blessed, common direction. On our team, it wasn't easy to get to that place. The day before the game saw an emotional discussion. Everybody was expressing their feelings, talking about what they'd been through emotionally, physically, and spiritually over the previous 24 hours. And some people had different ideas about the protests. Trying to help all of us understand was not easy, and conversations definitely got heated. I can't even say that we truly came together. We talked about all kinds of things we could do. And in the end, we had about 75% of the team buying into the locker room plan. We also issued a statement that I'm very proud of, explaining our reasons. It read, "As a team, we have decided we will not participate in the national anthem. We will not stand for the injustice that has plagued people of color in this country. Out of love for our country and in honor of the sacrifices made on our behalf, we unite to oppose those that would deny our most basic freedoms. We remain committed in continuing to work towards freedom and equality for all." A big group of us worked on the statement, crafting every word. Different people picked apart and wrote certain sentences or pointed out what they wanted changed. There's an expression, "A horse by committee is a hippopotamus." But I thought we ended up with a pretty cool hippopotamus. One aspect of the experience that was really special was when our quarterback, Russell Wilson, stepped up in the locker room, and with the media, in support of all of us. We've got some big personalities in this locker room, and up to this point, Russell had never been at the center of it when the political fires were hot. But he got in front of the team, and I was just proud to know him. He was vulnerable. He was emotional. And he made clear that doing nothing wasn't an option. He said to the press later, "I was passionate about it because I am really more concerned about what is next for our future and for our future kids and what we are going to do with the people who are going to lead this world someday. I pray for my kids every day that when they go to school, that racism isn't a thing that stops them from going where they want to go. It's not just my kids, it's your kids, it's everybody's kids. And I think that is really critical." That was on my heart especially. It meant a lot to the players, but it also meant a lot to the 12s, the crew of Seahawks fans around the world. Russell is a superhero to both black and white communities in our area. He's an icon. His service work is unreal. And for him finally to voice his opinion on behalf of the people who look like him, who celebrate him but can't afford to go to a game, was the embodiment of rising up when the times demand it. It's a reminder not to judge someone for not speaking out, but to create the space so that when their time comes, they're ready. Russell shifted a lot of people's perspective on the protests because he has a whole other audience. For him to say it changes a lot. As for the games that Sunday, they were a blur. That's how intense the reaction was. Every contest felt overshadowed. It was the first time in this country that sports operated on this elevated level with everybody watching what we were going to do politically. That's never really happened before, ever. It wasn't perfect. There is no doubt that the original message of protesting racism in the criminal justice system and showing solidarity with Colin Kaepernick got a little lost. How could it not? Yet I think we just have to keep pushing forward. We have to keep going so more people can get involved. A few weeks later, a committed group of players was present at the annual NFL owners meeting in New York City. I was proud of what we were able to win. Economic support from the league for some of our programs in particular. But I don't want us to fold so quickly just because the franchise owners chose to go with the carrot instead of the stick. In the meantime, I'm going to keep sitting and using the space during the anthem to protest, because there are two parts of how things have gone down that feel wrong to me. The first is when Cowboys owner Jerry Jones said that players disrespecting the flag won't play, period. That's crazy to me. Saying we'll celebrate freedom by forcing people to stand. Then he explained that he was helping us because we need consequences in order to stand up to peer pressure. I'm a 32-year-old man, father of three, and that's the most patronizing shit I've ever heard in my life. If you think about what Jones said, it's treating players like they're not human beings. It reminded me of the Dred Scott case. Your property, so you don't have the ability to be a person first. It sends a terrible message to young people that your employer doesn't see you as a human being. They see you as a piece of property. We have every right, according to our union and according to the freedoms we are supposed to be honoring, to use that space to do what we like. This game has given us so much, but it also takes so much away. Our health, our time with our families. It seems like Jerry Jones is on the hunt for our dignity and our humanity, too. The second part that sits wrong with me is that I believe central to any conversation about standing for the anthem is making sure Colin Kaepernick has an opportunity to play in the NFL. Before we negotiate anything about whether we sit or whether we stand, we need those doors for Colin to open up, to stop the collusion against him. It felt so wrong for us to have the opportunity to be able to speak honestly with our employers, but for the guy who started everything not to have a voice or a seat at that table. Going forward, we know that the owners are driven more by the financial bottom line, while we have more of a social justice view, so trying to align those is going to be hard. I will say that the best way that they can show that they are truly with us is, as of this writing, to sign Kaepernick. He deserves more than just a place on a team. He needs to be on the front lines of what we are doing. Any effort to erase him from this moment needs to be fought. Some members of the media have been frothing like junkyard dogs throughout this whole experience, and fans outside Seattle yell things at us now that wouldn't be out of place in the Alabama of the 1950s. But truly, I felt surprisingly chill through the whole thing. I've been studying Martin Luther King Jr. a lot, reading biographies and his speeches, and one of the bits of wisdom I've gained is that hate comes at you when you make any stand. It's the price of trying to be heard. If that's the case and we accept it, then it's a waste of emotion to react to the negativity. The hate, the rage that people throw at you only has power if you let it affect you. I know that's easier said than done, but I want to enjoy every single day and feel great about the power of this struggle that we're building. Dr. King tried to love life, make time for his family, and keep his humanity intact. Reading his lectures and spiritual teachings is pushing me toward a clearer understanding of what you have to do to find balance. Reacting to every slight, whether from someone online or even the president, doesn't put you in the right mind to make smart, calculated moves. The week after all this happened, I was doing my regular work with youth at a jail detention center talking to the kids about what makes a person strong. I asked them, if I'm sitting in front of a white man and he calls me a nigger, am I a man if I punch him in the face? Or am I a man if I think about my kids and think about the consequences of what could happen if I did punch him? For me, that was a reflective moment, to acknowledge that I'm a man if I think about my family first, not if I think about myself first. It's not about the short-term satisfaction of responding to every impulse. This approach allowed me in the aftermath to experience true grace in a lot of situations that I don't think the president expected to create. I felt that grace the week after the big Sunday showdown, when I rolled up to practice in my car and saw people protesting outside our practice facility with signs indicating they were vets and waving American flags. I pulled over outside the security gate and got out of my car to talk to them. I'll admit it was a little scary because I didn't know if they had guns. But I saw them protesting and I was just like, fuck it, let's talk. At first they were shocked. I don't think they expected to be talking with players when they showed up to the facility with their flags and signs, but it was cool. We just shared our experiences. We talked back and forth about where we disagree, yet how we want the same things, and what the flag means to them. They said I could never understand what they've been through as military veterans, but they also admitted with a great deal of humility that they could never understand what I've been through as a black man in America. I also explained, and it seems I can't repeat this enough, that these protests are not about the military, and they should not believe anyone who says otherwise. The vet said they understood all that. They just wished we didn't disrespect the flag. I told them we did not disrespect the flag. We're trying to honor what the flag is supposed to represent. And, kind of like an after-school special, we expressed to one another that we could all understand what it means to be human, with a need to protect our families. Then another woman pulled up. She was bawling her eyes out because she was driving by and saw the protest signs, the flags, and us talking with emotion. She said she was caught between the old and the new. She loved the Seahawks but didn't want anyone in the military to feel bad. She wanted to respect the military and also support equality. We ended up talking for about 20 or 30 minutes. Nice lady. I am glad she pulled over for safety reasons alone. Don't ever sob and drive. That's just dangerous. But I was also ready for it. Throughout this experience, people have been coming up to me very emotional, saying, "Thank you." Black and brown people who have felt the sting of inequality. White people who are wrestling with these injustices for the first time, crying as if they are newborn, angry at the world they're seeing now that they're out of the womb. And yes, vets who have said to me that military personnel are divided in their opinions as much as anyone else, and they didn't want me to cave to the bullshit. For me, it's been powerfully emotional and a little bit over the top. Seriously, imagine people coming up to you weeping several times a day. It can be exhausting, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. For all the people who say they hate me and want me out of this country, which my family's blood and sweat built from the ground up, there are more people who sympathize with what we are all trying to do, who want to see a better world. I treasure this time because it's like water in a canteen, and in the future, when my throat is dry, I'm going to remember all these people and keep pushing forward with my eyes on the prize. The goal is worth the sacrifice. For me, it's always been about the human interaction, pushing people to respect one another in every facet of life. The loss of a human life is the hardest on those left behind. That's the end of everything. There are no more walks in the park. Black Lives Matter is saying that all of our lives have value. If a soldier loses his life, it's just as important as Tamir Rice losing his life. We need to celebrate every life and mourn every death because behind everyone is a family in pain. As everything was raging all around me, the president cursing my name, fans yelling slurs, I felt oddly at peace. Martellus said to me, "Bro, you sound like you're 60 years old." But that doesn't mean there wasn't fear. We need to talk about fear, because when you feel that fear, it means shit is real. On fear. It can be a burden to stand up and speak your truth. You feel disheveled, isolated, like you are holding up the earth and it could all come crashing down. You know it's going to be hard before you start because so many people tell you not to do it, to be quiet, to shut up and play. But it's even harder than they warned you. The anxiety will scratch at your insides like the creature in Alien, except it never bursts out of your chest. It just stays there, scratching. You grow up wanting to be a positive force, to try and change the world for the better. But when the opportunity comes to step up, when it knocks at your door, I can tell you the question changes. It goes from, "Wow, wouldn't it be great to do something like that?" to, "Damn. Do I really want to do something like that? Do I really want to put my family at risk? Do I really want to be judged by people who don't know me or care to understand my motivations, no matter how clear I make them?" It's like the difference between watching Die Hard, thinking how cool it would be to take on a building full of terrorists, and doing it in real life, shoeless in the Nakatomi building, jumping off the roof with a fire hose tied around your waist. You'd be scared as hell, peeing down your leg. It takes a lot to put everything on the line. Your livelihood, your morals, your community, everything. I suspect a lot of people think from a distance that it's not that hard to do, like, oh, I'd be on the front lines. I'd sit. I'd raise a fist. I'd take a knee. But it's so much easier to talk shit than to do shit, because once you are out there representing what you believe, people see the real you. Most everybody in the world wears a mask, and very rarely do people unveil who they really are. And I've done that. I'm naked here. So I'm going to be judged by strangers on the core of who I am, and yes, that makes me vulnerable, and it can even feel terrifying. Nobody wants to lose his job like Kaepernick and risk becoming another former NFL player who ends up broke. But if the price of employment is silence, I just can't do it anymore. As I write this now, I'll tell you, I have a particular kind of fear pressing against my chest. I fear not being heard. That haunts me the most. I fear that people will just see the gesture of sitting during the anthem and not hear my reasons, or they'll accept the distortions put out by the media. That's why I'm writing a book, because this isn't about sound bites or tweets or Instagram quotes. This is about trying to push forward with a movement that can benefit all of us. I fear that if people don't hear what I'm trying to say because they don't get it or they don't want to get it, or because they have been indoctrinated to believe that the status quo is as good as it's going to get, then there will never be any kind of change. There will never be equality. I don't fear losing sponsors or friends or partners in my foundation, although that has already started to happen. When you step out like this, you can tell who your real friends are and who truly cares about you. If there are people in my life who don't believe in justice and equality, it probably means that I shouldn't even be messing with them, and that's fine. I'd rather know than not know. But please don't get me wrong. I do fear the possibility that someone is crazy enough to do something to me just because I'm taking this step. The fear is less for myself than for what it would do to my three daughters. Every single day I think about that. When I'm playing with them after practice or helping them with a project, I'm living in the moment with them as much as I can. I'm doing it more than ever at this point in my life. I'm taking great pains to appreciate every second, because you never know what might happen. In a strange way, it makes me feel more alive. It wasn't that long ago, 1965, when Malcolm X was killed. It wasn't that long ago, 1968, when Martin Luther King was killed. It wasn't that long ago, 1969, when Chicago Black Panther leader Fred Hampton was killed. Fred Hampton knew that the path he was taking would involve sacrifice, and one of those sacrifices ended up being his own life. And a few months ago, this young woman, Heather Heyer, goes out to protest some Nazis with her whole life in front of her, and she's killed. I'm in no way comparing myself to them. I bring them up to illustrate that from my perspective, it's no wonder more people haven't stepped up. The fear that your life could be snatched is real. Aaron McGruder, the comic artist who created The Boondocks, said that he came up with the character of Huey Freeman, the elementary school militant, precisely so we could have a black voice they couldn't kill. I asked Angela Davis, someone who has gotten enough death threats in the last 50 years to wallpaper the Smithsonian Black History Museum in D.C., how she has dealt with the fear of someone visiting violence upon her head. She wrote me back and said, "Yes, I've experienced that fear. But over time I've learned to accept it in a way that does not immobilize me. Despite all the death threats, I'm still here. Therefore, as the saying goes, I must also be a witness for those who did not make it." I truly like that idea of being a witness for those who did not make it. That's very powerful, even sacred. The Seahawks locker room has been so supportive because they know my principles and my convictions. They know I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have reasons. I think they feel like what I'm saying makes sense in a country where we have Klan marching without hoods. Who can disagree with human rights? Who can disagree with fighting injustice? Who can disagree with fighting inequality? If demonstrating for these things makes you uncomfortable, the question should not be, why are you doing this? The question needs to be turned around. Why are you not? We don't all have to agree. Disagreements are fine, even healthy. But when crowds are marching with torches and assault rifles intimidating people from speaking out, and a woman loses her life, the whole narrative changes. I told my coach, Pete Carroll, I feel morally wrong to be silent. I feel like silence right now would be an act of dishonesty to people who look like me and people that look up to me. At this point in time, it just doesn't make sense for me not to do what's right. And I know that this might be hard for you to understand because it's hard for a white man to understand what it feels like to be black. Pete Carroll listened, looked at me, and said, I can't disagree with you. He later said to the media, Michael has really dedicated the last few years of his life to try to understand what's going on around the world. He has traveled everywhere to try and understand people's issues and concerns. It has really captured his heart, and he has really turned his focus to doing good work and helping people and doing everything he can for things that he thinks where he can help. I support the heck out of his concerns and his issues and all that. In an odd, funky way, football has prepared me for this more than probably any sport or other job could, save ones that hold the regular risk of physical danger. When you take the field, you have to go out there with the mentality that any play could be your last, and you have to be at peace with that. You have to not just live in the moment, but be in the moment. Full situational awareness. There have been times I felt afraid. Having our first baby, I was afraid, because our daughter Peyton was so tiny and fragile, and I worried that turning this precious thing into a grown woman was an overwhelming, if not impossible, task. I'm having a similar feeling as I write this book. It's the fear of the unknown. I have no idea where this journey will take me. I also fear how public my life is, and that it is so damn easy to find me because everyone knows where I'm going to be on a Sunday. What are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to just live in fear? Are you supposed to put on a mask and act like nothing is bothering you? Are you supposed to hide behind bodyguards and build more and more walls? That's not a life. Whether I die tomorrow or in 60 years, if the only things about me that people talk about are the Pro Bowls and the Super Bowl appearances, I will have failed. I want my legacy to be what I did in the community, and the positive changes this work might have created in people's lives. I want people to know that I was a man of my word, someone who followed through, someone who didn't just talk it, but walked it. Records are made to be broken, but the legacy you leave can't be broken because it's the truth. I've left a lot on that field. I don't want my legacy to be a limp or a damaged mind. I'm going to have my say and use this platform while I can. It's a brutal league, but the truth is that as soon as I leave, my platform will shrink. I have got to speak while I still have the microphone about the NFL, my life, injustice, organizing, and the most amazing locker room in sports. Some of the topics in this book may make you uncomfortable. I'm going to talk about white owners and black players. I'm going to talk about the word nigger. I'm going to talk about my beautiful scarred body. It might make you uncomfortable, but shit, a lot of what's in here makes me uncomfortable. It makes me vulnerable. And if I'm uncomfortable, why should it just be me? I hope this book makes you laugh and makes you think. I hope if it makes you throw it in the garbage, you fish it out 5 minutes later and keep reading. I hope that whatever you think of this book, in the words of my man Maximus, you will be entertained. Roots. The triumph can't be had without the struggle. Wilma Rudolph. When I was 11, I lifted a tractor with my bare hands. My grandpa, Alfred Bennett, was underneath fixing the tractor, and the thing was about to fall on him. I didn't want to see him hurt, so I picked the tractor up and said, "Popo, get out from under there." He scurried out and, true to the man, got right back to work farming. He didn't miss a beat. My cousins froze and just looked at me. Then one of them shook his head and said, "You strong as fuck." I was. It was old school strength, developed from the moment I could stand. I was the oldest son, and both my grandpas were farmers. That meant I worked in the Louisiana fields during the summers, which gave me my calluses. My job was picking okra and bell peppers and carrying buckets for whatever pay Popo would throw at me. That's what I did when school wasn't in session. Farm chores and, when needed, lifting up a tractor. When it was time to have some fun, we body slammed each other in the cow pastures right into the mud, pretending to be the wrestler Stone Cold Steve Austin, while the cows looked at us like we were crazy. Those buckets also strengthened my hands. I've got hands that can crush walnuts. Maybe that is why I wear the tiniest shoulder pads in the NFL. I've never felt the need to enhance anything. As a kid, I loved the story about Paul Bunyan, the all-natural muscle man, and I want to feel my muscles work, not just for strength, but for speed and flexibility. I still do the same workout. I still lift rice buckets, pull weights, and make sure I'm not just gym strong, but farm strong. It's like I'm the Black Rocky from Rocky IV when he was training on that Russian farm. Or maybe Rocky is the white me. But it was when I lifted that tractor and saw the looks on my cousins' faces that I knew I might have a different path from working in the fields. Louisiana is the foundation for my life. My town goes back to the 1800s. A lot of my family still lives on a street called Bennett Road. Same school, same community, same church. It's where we settled after we were no longer enslaved people, and where the Bennetts have proudly made not just a home, but a community. Like I said, both of my grandpas were farmers and worked in the fields. My Popo Alfred also was, and still is, a Southern Baptist preacher. He can preach with the best of them, as good as any of the television pastors in their $3,000 suits. But he worked with his hands to build his own church in his backyard and packed it every Sunday. Because the church was next to the house, he once caught us playing Nintendo instead of getting ready for services, so he stopped what he was doing, smashed our Nintendo, and got right back to preparing his sermon. He taught me about the Bible, how to hunt and fish, plant, and work a tractor. I learned how to body slam from pro wrestling. One time he had me slaughter a goat, and I did it wrong. The goat bled out quickly, but I felt terrible to see a living creature die. Popo didn't care. He just said, "Death is death, no matter what. When it dies, it's dead." That has never left me. No matter what it is, when something is gone, it's gone. So make your mark. Making that journey from boy to man might have been easier if we had stayed on Bennett Road, but that was not going to be the case. My father, Michael Sr., otherwise known as Big Mike, and my birth mother, Karanda, started having kids when my mom was 16. I was the second of five and the oldest boy. Martellus was born 18 months after me. By the time my mom was 17, she and my dad had three kids, and then five kids by age 22. My dad and mom married right after they both finished high school. They never really got to be teenagers, just went from being kids to being parents. It wasn't any kind of scandal. In a small southern town, it's normal for people to get pregnant early and get married. But it also meant tough decisions that affected their lives to this day. My dad had a scholarship to play college football at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, but he abandoned those dreams to support his growing family and joined the Navy. Yes, my dad was in the Navy, so again, don't speak to me about certain players being unpatriotic for taking a knee. Joining the Navy meant leaving Bennett Road in Louisiana and moving to San Diego when I was six. San Diego was one of the biggest Navy towns in the country, and we lived there as a family until I was eight, when my mom and dad decided to go their separate ways. That isn't too unusual, but what was different from most divorced families was the decision they made with us kids. Out of the five children, the two youngest went with my mom. Martellus and I stayed with my dad, and my older sister went back to Louisiana to live with our grandma. The family was split, leaving me with the feeling that somehow my birth mother didn't choose me. As I've grown older, I've realized that marriage is hard. To give up your selfish plans in order to build a life with somebody and to continue to grow while keeping your family together. It can feel next to impossible. Sometimes people grow apart, and trying to keep the family together at all costs can cause so much unintended damage. As long as all the children end up cared for and loved, there is nothing more important. I often think about their choice to split up and separate the kids, how different everything would have been if we'd stayed together, or if we'd been divided up in another way, or if Martellus and I didn't end up moving to Houston with a new mom when I was 10 years old. To be honest, if I'd stayed in Southern California, I might not be writing this at all because gang violence was all over the place. There'd be drive-bys on the way to school, and stray bullets were a daily part of my young life. There were teenage twins who lived in the neighborhood, both with colostomy bags. They couldn't even control their piss and shit because they'd been hit by stray bullets. My dad kept Tellus and me clear of the worst of it, but there were no real safe spaces. I remember one time a guy in a gang beat up a girl so badly that a group of her people started looking for him. He was running through the neighborhood, jumping over fences, cutting through yards. Our front door was open because us kids were playing football out front. So he ran through our door and headed straight through our house and out the back. About 45 minutes later, all these gang kids pulled up in their car. They looked ready to search our house, armed like the Expendables, announcing that they were going to get this guy. My dad came out, no guns, calm as can be, and said, "Y'all come into this house, there's going to be some problems." Then our neighbor appeared with a massive shotgun and said, "If y'all motherfuckers move, there's going to be a shootout." Now everybody tensed up. My dad stood in the middle and told everyone to chill their asses out, that there were kids around. He explained to everyone that this dude who ran through our house was nobody we knew. "We don't know what he did to this girl. This has nothing to do with my home or my family." The gang kids huddled up, and a couple of them realized that they knew my dad from his work as a volunteer flag football coach for kids around the neighborhood. One of the dudes replied, "Nah, you good. You would never do nothing like that." They slowly backed away and waited around the corner. I don't know what happened next, but I can't imagine it was anything nice. After that, we moved our asses to Texas. You know it's bad where you're living when you're worried about guns and see Texas as a safe alternative. But we really moved because my dad met the woman I would learn to call my mom. In Louisiana, for my Uncle Earl's funeral, my dad met Miss Penny, was struck by lightning where he stood, and just said, "We're moving." I think about what my life would be if I'd never had the blessing of Miss Penny, my new mom. A Grambling State University graduate and junior high school teacher, a woman who taught me to stand up for myself. Miss Penny's entrance into our family was a defining moment of my life. She was somebody who would not let us be normal, who said that no matter what the world tried to beat into our heads, we could be extraordinary. When I got in trouble, my punishment from her wasn't spankings or sitting in a corner. It was reading encyclopedias. At first I hated it, but I learned to love this punishment and would get in trouble just to have some quiet space to learn about the world. Later I read that studying encyclopedias was what Malcolm X did in prison to self-educate, and it blew my mind. Miss Penny had been there for every important moment of my life. Everything I've learned I can see now came from her. How to be the kind of father who can raise daughters. How to love. How to navigate this world. I see a lot of kids ask, why, as in, why are we here? Why is there war? Why are people hungry? and they get a spanking for asking too many questions. Miss Penny demanded that we ask why, and believe me, I took her up on that. I wanted to know why there was hate in the world, why my school wasn't teaching me about our history, and why it felt like, from the schoolyard to the candy store, white kids were treated differently from black kids. When I asked her why, she would answer, "I know what it's like out there, and I'll teach you the truth so you understand. But I'm also going to teach you how to survive." She told us we weren't allowed to wear braids or saggy pants. This was not because she thought they looked bad or ghetto, but because she knew what could happen if we were judged to be somebody we weren't. Miss Penny was always in my business, scared of what society would have in store for me as a young black man if I wasn't on alert, reminding me that racism was real, and I'd have to work twice as hard for anything I wanted. Before Trayvon Martin's murder brought it into some white people's consciousness, black families have always known, as my mom knew, that if I looked like I was in the wrong neighborhood, or if there was a case of mistaken identity, I could be put down for the crime of walking while black. I was always reminded that being black was dangerous, that people would see my skin as a weapon, a threat. But my mom's lessons didn't sink in until I was 12 years old, when a man named James Byrd was murdered in Jasper, Texas, lynched and dragged behind a truck. It brought the history that I was learning to life, the beating and lynching of 14-year-old Emmett Till in 1955, and his mother's insistence on an open casket so the world could see what they did to her baby. Mamie Till was also a teacher, like Miss Penny, and I saw myself in Emmett Till's disfigured face. And I saw my community through the eyes of James Byrd, eyes that were popping out of his skull as he was dragged by the neck from a chain. And I cried until it hurt. The lynching of James Byrd happened just 100 miles from my house, and it felt like it happened 100 yards away. A mental line was drawn in the sand for me, and I don't think I was ever the same again. I saw black leaders running around asking for justice again, for another tragedy of a slain black man. It felt like nothing had changed from Emmett Till's day. It felt like we were being hunted and trophied to be mounted on someone's wall. I have never admitted this before, but I was scared to walk home at night by myself out of fear that I could be next. For a long while, every time a pickup truck rumbled around the corner, my breath caught in my chest. This was Texas, so pickups were everywhere, which meant that for a while, my heart just raced nonstop. I wasn't the only one in the Bennett household on edge. I remember the time Martellus decided he was going to get lost for the whole day, normal kid stuff. But he didn't tell anybody, and my father went searching for him, guns cocked, loaded, and thinking that the worst could have happened to his young black child. It made us feel threatened. But it also held a poisonous message that being black was inferior, that somehow we deserved to be hunted and killed. In Louisiana and Texas, we'd see stories on television of shootings, deaths, Klan marches. In school, we never learned how black people built this country. We built America for free, but in class, our contributions were invisible, at best there to entertain or the same lesson about George Washington Carver, as if we were slaves, invented peanut butter, and became entertainers and that's our entire story. We built the White House. We built the Capitol building. We built the Light of Freedom on top of the Capitol building. That's this country. The Light of Freedom, built by slaves. Being born black is a pre-existing condition in this society, with a set of stressors that you can't understand without living in our skin. It's not just the fear that you'll be the next James Byrd or Trayvon Martin or Sandra Bland. It's hearing dumb shit in school about America being the land of the free and having to speak up to remind my teacher of slavery and seeing all the faces change expression from getting red with anger to others rolling their eyes with looks of relief on the faces of people who have been thinking the same thing. I felt like Kevin in the Wonder Years, if Kevin had been black and had to face an ass-whooping every day for trying to tell the truth. I've tried to tell people in Seattle, and I love Seattle, that yes, Seattle has its problems, But there are parts of this country that are a lot worse when it comes to these issues. Of course there's racism in Seattle. But in Texas, it's right in your face. You're hearing about people getting hanged. You're seeing the KKK. There are Confederate monuments to people who owned your great-grandparents